He's stinky, but who cares? Michelle said. Dylan responded well to EI. I was one of these people who would have been annoyed that my son's preschool had special needs kids that might slow them down, Michelle said. So I make myself perfectly charming to the other mothers. The woman who runs his nursery school believes in inclusion as a way of life. She called me the second week of school and said, he has a major gas problem. Make no mistake about it. He's already different. If he's now the smelly little kid with Down syndrome, people are not going to want to play with him. That was brutally, beautifully honest. We found Beano, which is an enzyme that controls the gas. Michelle, nonetheless, expects Dylan's sweetness to carry the day. My grandmother got this little puppy, and he was trying to figure this puppy out. He had his favorite puzzle piece in his hand, and he gave it to the puppy. He gives his favorite things away. He's heart spontaneous. Michelle has the zeal of a convert. It was like I was trying to get FM on an AM radio in my old life. In a weird way, it was like this happened so I could see what I was capable of. Every single trait that I wasn't good at, I've had to develop because of him. I was living superficially and attached to my ego and my stuff and my image. I was very judgmental, critical. And how can I be judgmental of anything now? We're supposed to share all of our talents and gifts, but we have to know what they are first. Now, I have to help people, instead of just using my talents to make money. Michelle consults with new parents, encouraging them to keep their children with DS. In the one case in which the couple gave up the child for adoption, she was devastated. I asked her about people who didn't share her dynamism, spirituality, and sense of purpose. They all do, she said. That's the wild thing with special needs parents. This comes raging out of you. I feel such strength and courage in these women. I say to them all the time, I know you don't feel like you know what you're doing. Trust me. You are the perfect mother for this kid. She paused for a second and smiled. You know, they probably want to smack me. In about 95% of cases, Down syndrome is the result of a spontaneous mutation rather than a transmissible gene, and people who have DS seldom reproduce. Because DS was among the first major genetic anomalies for which prenatal testing existed, and because it is the most common genetic anomaly that can be detected in utero, it has been at the center of the abortion debate. Statistics range, but at present, about 70% of expectant mothers who receive a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome choose to abort. Ironically, outcomes for people with DS have improved more radically in the last 40 years than have the outcomes for most any other anomaly. People who would have languished in institutions and died at 10 are now reading and writing and working. With adequate education and health care, many live more than 60 years. The national life expectancy for people with DS in the United States is around 50, double the 1983 figure. People with Down syndrome are also interacting with a world that has many more accommodations for people with special needs. Supported employment means that many higher-functioning people with DS can find jobs. The general tolerance in society means that a person with DS arriving at a restaurant or a store with his family is more likely to be received graciously. In a recent study in Canada, parents of children with DS were asked whether they would pursue a cure if one were available. More than a quarter said they would not, and another third said they were not sure. Targeted abortion had been expected to eliminate most of the population with Down syndrome, but the proportion of people born with the condition in any given year has increased or remained constant since testing was introduced. Such children are not evenly distributed across the population. 80% of Down syndrome births are to women under 35 who have not had testing, and many of these are poor, as wealthier people are more likely to seek prenatal testing, even if they are not in a risk category. Studies suggest that among people who carry to term, those with fewer material advantages may be less perfectionistic and ambitious for their children, and therefore more readily accepting of the permanent dependence of children with DS. Some agencies specialize in arranging adoptions of children with DS. The head of one said to me, "I wish I could show you a list of the people who've given up their babies to me. It would read like who's who in America." More women choosing to have prenatal testing and abort fetuses diagnosed with DS brings the DS population down, while more women conceiving in later life brings it up. As people with DS who used to die at 10 are living to 60, the number of people on the planet with Down syndrome is increasing. The number in the United States may double between 2000 and 2025 to as much as 800,000. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommended in 2007 that all pregnant women undergo nuchal translucency in the first trimester, with the option of genetic counseling and amniocentesis, or CVS, in the second trimester for those with poor nuchal translucency results. Disability rights groups opposed this protocol. The conservative columnist George Will, who has a son with DS, called it a search-and-destroy mission. Moderates have asked that people simply be better informed about the experience of parenting a child with Down syndrome. Stephen Quake, a Stanford professor who developed one of the new blood tests for DS, said, "It's a gross oversimplification to assume that these tests are going to lead to the wholesale elimination of Down syndrome births. My wife's cousin has Down syndrome. He's a wonderful person. It's not an obvious step that you would terminate an affected pregnancy." Nonetheless, activists worry that women who want to keep a DS pregnancy may feel pressured to terminate as prenatal diagnosis gets easier. People without health insurance have a much harder time obtaining prenatal tests, and some worry that this will make DS into a poor man's condition. In contrast, Michael Berube points out that having children with DS could become the province of the rich if prenatal screening becomes universal and insurance ceases to cover the medical and educational costs for those who keep such children. The existence of tests provides an imperative to use and act on them. One study said that women who do not use prenatal testing or who keep a pregnancy they know will lead to a child with a disability were judged more responsible, more to blame, and less deserving of both sympathy and social aid subsequent to giving birth to a disabled child than were women to whom testing was not made available. These demographic suppositions seem to cancel each other out and point to the confusion around conditions such as DS, which can be considered both burden and luxury, sometimes by the same person. Michael Berube wrote, "So much depends on whether our technologies serve our social desires or our social desires are made to serve our technologies." In a newspaper interview, he added, "The $15 million spent on the new test for Down by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development might have gone instead toward much-needed research on the biochemistry of people living with the condition." Prenatal screening and support for people with DS should not be mutually exclusive, any more than cochlear implants have to engender the death of sign, any more than a vaccine for an infectious disease should prevent our treating people who develop it. In the pragmatic economy of modern medicine, however, an ounce of prevention is usually held to be worth a ton of cure. As the techniques for prenatal diagnosis of DS have become more available, funding for research in the field has diminished. This seems particularly tragic because treatment for the major symptoms of DS, long considered impossible, is now a field full of promise. In 2006, Alberto Costa demonstrated that Prozac could normalize the compromised development of the hippocampus in mice that had a Down's-like condition. He later found that the Alzheimer's drug memantine boosted memory in similar mice, most likely by quieting neurotransmitter systems that he believes interfere with learning in DS. In 2009, William C. Mobley, chairman of neurosciences at the University of California, San Diego, showed that raising norepinephrine levels in the brains of these mice allowed them to learn at the level of typical mice. In 2010, Paul Greengard of Rockefeller University normalized learning and memory in such mice by lowering levels of beta amyloid, which is also implicated in Alzheimer's disease. Mobley said, "There's been a sea change in our ability to understand and treat Down syndrome. There's been an explosion of information. As recently as 2000, no drug company would possibly have thought about developing therapies for Down syndrome. I am now in contact with no less than 4 companies that are pursuing treatments." Commenting in the New York Times, Craig C. Garner, co-director of the Center for Research and Treatment of Down Syndrome at Stanford University, said, "This was a disorder for which it was believed there was no hope, no treatment, and people thought, why waste your time? The last 10 years have seen a revolution in neuroscience, so that we now realize that the brain is amazingly plastic, very flexible, and systems can be repaired. As with the deaf and their implants, and dwarfs and their ELL, this is another scramble. Not so much for identity this time, as for science. If people with DS can be normalized, should we think more carefully about terminating DS pregnancies?" Costa said, "The geneticists expect Down syndrome to disappear. So why fund treatments? It's like we're in a race against the people who are promoting those early screening methods. If we're not quick enough to offer alternatives, this field might collapse." Angelica Roman Jimenez was 27 when her daughter Erica was born in 1992. Erica was a first child, and there had been no thought of doing amniocentesis. But when the baby was born, Angelica knew that something was wrong. "I remember holding the doctor's arm and saying, 'Please tell me.' My husband, I could see it in his eyes." The doctor told Angelica that her baby had mild Down syndrome, though there is no way to tell the severity of Down symptoms in a newborn. The doctors offered the possibility of adoption, but Angelica was not interested. Still, she wondered how to tell people. "I called my parents. I said, 'The baby was born with—' and I couldn't finish the sentence. My father said, 'Well, does she have all her fingers? Does she have all her toes?' I said, 'Yes, yes.' He said, 'Whatever it is, we'll deal with it.' You always hear about unconditional love for your children, no matter what. And there it was. Her priest said, 'God gave you this child for a reason. Anything that I've seen come your way, you're able to tackle it. And this will be the same.'" Not everyone had the grace to respond in kind. "A lot of our friends looked at it as a death," Angelica said. "I couldn't move from why. Why did this happen to us? But then you realize, wait a minute, she's alive. She needs our love and attention." "I still wanted to do birth announcements, and I sent along a letter describing what our lives were now." Though she is Catholic, Angelica was working in a clerical job at Trinity Episcopal Church in Lower Manhattan, and a co-worker had a friend who had a child with Down syndrome. "She stayed on the phone with me for over an hour and told me which books to read, to stay away from anything earlier than the 80s, to join a parents' support group. That was when I broke out of that 'why' It helped that Erica was born the same year that Jane Pauley featured Jason Kingsley on her program. Images of people with DS were proliferating, as they had not even a few years earlier. Within 6 weeks, Angelica had enrolled Erica in an early intervention program. When your child is born with a disability, all your high hopes and dreams are shattered. When she was one, I was always looking to see whether she was keeping up with the other children at the center. She was struggling with her grasp, her gross and fine motor skills. Then one day, she had the coordination to pick up a Cheerio, and I wanted to jump for joy. A few years later, she needed ear tubes. Of course, we wanted to do our best there, because if you can't hear, how is your language going to develop? So the doctor said, well, she's never going to be perfect. I felt, how dare he say that? He's never going to be perfect either. Speech development was ongoing. She would point at what she wanted, and we would encourage her. Tell us what you want. One time she had an evaluation for school, and the psychologist asked me whether Erica made her bed in the morning. I said, well, no, we're in a rush. I'll just do it and we'll go. She checked off, not given the opportunity. Now, I try always to give her the opportunity, whether it's zippering up her coat, tying her shoelace. She can write her name, address, and phone number. Erica struggles with poor judgment, as do many people with DS. We try to teach her, this is danger, this is not, Angelica said. She's very trusting, without stranger anxiety. We've taught her that when she meets someone for the first time, she should shake hands. We have to explain, you can't hug everyone. Not everyone is nice. Angelica looked sober. She doesn't get phone calls. She doesn't get a lot of party invitations. We've had her in programs with other children who have disabilities, ballet and music classes. I feel these other children with special needs are her peers. I want her to have that close friend who is going through the same thing she is. I started a Girl Scout troop for exceptional girls. We have girls who are autistic, girls with Down syndrome, girls who are wheelchair bound. This work occupies a great deal of Angelica's time. I also have a younger daughter, Leah, who is in those preteen years, and sometimes she's concerned about how she's seen by others. Will they accept me if I have a sister with special needs? We tell Leah, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. This is how God gave her to us. Erica shows no sign of knowing that she could ever be perceived as an embarrassment. She realizes that she can't run as fast as other kids, or she can't jump rope the way other people do. But she's never asked me why. Erica is, if you're good to me, I'll be good to you. Part of me wants her to be aware, and the other part is, well, if she's aware, she won't be happy. Angelica had been deeply committed from the first to finding meaning in her experience, and she came to see Erica's disability as an occasion for her own moral growth. When Erica was 9, Angelica developed breast cancer. Having Erica made me stronger to deal with that, Angelica said. I became this stronger person because of her. Trinity Church is only a few blocks from Ground Zero, and Angelica was there on 9/11. She kept her cool in the midst of the chaos, and for that too she thanks Erica. God makes these things happen to us sooner rather than later, because maybe our role will be to help others and to grow from this experience, she said. That's what I feel my ministry is now, to let folks know and invite them to my home, to have conversations. I couldn't stop the planes from coming. I couldn't stop my illness or her condition. You can't stop the future. In her memoir, Expecting Adam, Martha Beck writes, if you'll cast your mind back to high school biology, You may remember that a species is defined in part by the number of chromosomes in every individual. Adam's extra chromosome makes him as dissimilar from me as a mule is from a donkey. Adam doesn't just do less than a normal child his age might. He does different things. He has different priorities, different tastes, different insights. Beck writes of the transformations her son has wrought in her life. The immediacy and joy with which he makes his life make rapacious achievement Harvard style look a lot like quiet desperation. Adam has slowed me down to the point where I notice what is in front of me, its mystery and beauty, instead of thrashing my way through a maze of difficult requirements toward labels and achievements that contain no joy in themselves. Children with Down syndrome tend to retain what the experts call babyfaceness. These children have a small, concave nose with a sunken bridge, smaller features, larger forehead, and shorter chin, and fuller cheeks and rounder chin, resulting in a rounder face. A recent study found that both the register in which parents speak to their DS child and the variances in pitch resembled the voice patterns parents use to speak to infants and young children. So the infantilizing comes from parents who don't think they're doing it, in response to a biological facial structure that they may not consciously register as meaningful. Intellectual inequality places certain limits on intimacy for parents. Yet studies show that fathers of DS children spend much more time with their affected children than most fathers spend with their typical children. Other studies show that, on average, children act more kindly, more generously, and with less hostility toward siblings with Down syndrome than toward typically developing siblings. They are also more compassionate and mature. This is true even though siblings of mentally retarded children can suffer social ostracism and are at elevated risk of emotional and psychological problems. DS and non-DS sibling relationships are both warm and courteous, stripped of the volatility of relations between equals. Play between non-Down siblings and their DS counterparts is more hierarchical and may contain less laughter. Yet writing in Newsweek about her brother with DS, Colgan Leeming said, "My brother is not his disability. He is a teenager who loves sports and PlayStation, who cares a little bit too much about his hair and is a little bit too confident, who is kind to every person he meets, who makes you laugh so hard your stomach hurts. He's a boy, just like anyone else. Kevin does not have special needs. All he needs is a chance." Sibling responses can rely on minimizing the disability, or on celebrating it, or on some combination of the two. Which mode gets used has something to do with the dynamics of a given family, and something to do with the severity of the affected person's deficits. It is easy to focus on the tales of people with DS who are triumphantly high-functioning, whose parents take great pleasure in how smart and successful they are within the parameters of the illness. Given how much less these children are likely to attain than typical children, however, to universalize intelligence and achievement as a measure of worth is in some ways to deny who they are. They are not so bright and can't accomplish so much by general standards, but have real virtues and are capable of personal fulfillment. Many parents of people with DS began their conversations with me by saying how super high-functioning their children were. And I began to wonder how it was that I saw only parents of such high-functioning kids. When I began talking to their children, I found that some of them were extraordinarily intelligent and advanced given their condition, and that many others had a few things at which they excelled, from which their parents cheerily generalized. The parents' perception of high functioning frequently outstripped the children's actual level of accomplishment. Without exception, these parents reported that their children tried hard to please them. Stubborn, intractable when stuck on an idea, the children nonetheless had an eagerness, not as typical of the other disorders examined in this book, that was infinitely moving to their parents. Down syndrome kids are famously sweet-natured, but their less advertised characteristic is that they are troopers. Adam Delibovi is at the lower end of Down syndrome function and is also diagnosed on the autism spectrum. At 26, he had a mental age of between 4 and 5, and to meet him after seeing Jason Kingsley speaking at Barnes & Noble made it difficult to believe they had the same condition. Adam's mother, Susan Arnston, was 22 and living in Ithaca, New York, when she realized she was pregnant. It was the late 70s. People were into alternative lives. I knew I wanted children, so since I wasn't doing anything else, I let it happen. Her parents hastily arranged a wedding for her. Her new husband, Jan Delibovi, had a nephew with Down syndrome, but it never occurred to them to do genetic screening. Adam was diagnosed the day after he was born. There wasn't a single, solitary moment when I considered giving him up for adoption, Susan said. I started looking, too quickly, at how I could use this challenge for something good. I didn't give myself time to grieve. My parents thought it was a tragedy, so I had to make it into just the opposite. I was a very young 22. Susan applied for Federal Supplementary Security Income, SSI, for Adam. When the first check came, Susan used it to enroll in a graduate-level course at Cornell called Learning and Children. She started volunteering in a daycare center and became involved with EI. Susan's research and learning were critical. A regular kid will initiate. They'll learn in spite of anything you do, Susan said. But with Adam, you had to kind of bring it to him, and he'd meet you maybe a quarter of the way. Shortly after his first smile, a physical therapist noticed that he was having strange spasms, and Susan took him in for a brain scan, which showed constant myoclonic seizures, which can cause severe retardation. Susan and Jan gave Adam 6 weeks of shots of ACTH, a stress-related hormone. They went to see a neurologist because Adam seemed to be suffering so badly with the shots. The neurologist said, if any healing is going to come, it's going to come from Adam. And really, the best thing you can do is pray. There was a very strong commune in this town called the Family, Susan remembered. They all had these names that their leader had given them, like Freedom and Grateful and Sought and Ocean and Sojourn. They started doing healing circles for us. They had this wonderful land with this wonderful pond where we would hang out naked with our babies and everybody would swim and talk. They came up with ideas about how his soul was trying to make up its mind whether to be in the world. Even as a newborn, you have to commit to engage in the world. And he didn't seem to have made up his mind when he first arrived here. When Susan took Adam back to the doctor, the seizures were gone. However, Adam had persistent upper respiratory infections, and he's largely deaf in his left ear. His vision was weak, and one of his eyes wandered. For a while, he wore an eye patch, and later, strong glasses. When Adam reached his first birthday, Susan's mother bought him a dog puppet, and he loved it most of all his things. Then he started developing all these weird behaviors, Susan said. He really liked to hold things and stare at them. So I'd be really mean. I would take the puppet and put it across the hall. Boy, he would crawl, and he would grab it. I would take it away, and he would go after it again. Then I started putting the puppet in clear boxes so he could see it in there and would have to figure out how to take it out. Susan and Jan conceived another baby, so Adam would have company, Susan said. Taciturn, suspicious, beautiful, and full of intensity, Tegan is fiercely loyal to her brother. Adam was in the public school system in his early years, and Tegan was constantly defending him. "If teachers didn't understand him, I would try to make them understand," she said. "I used to go into his classroom in the morning and spend time there until I was almost late for my own class. It was much more upsetting to me to see him teased than it was for him to be teased. A lot of the time, I don't think he even noticed." Tegan always brought her friends home to see her brother. "I used how they interacted with him as a measure of their character." By this time, Susan and Jan had split up, and Susan was doing her best to place Adam in a new school. The flip side of early intervention is it sets up expectations and pressures, she said. "You see all these wonder kids like Jason Kingsley, or that one who used to be on Life Goes On. Today, I think Adam has reached his maximum potential. But at that time, I felt maybe he wasn't doing as well as the others because I wasn't doing as much as other parents. In this little cohort of kids with Downs here in Ithaca, he was the slowest one." Susan had gone along with inclusion because it was what everyone else was doing, but Adam knew he didn't fit in. One day, he removed all his clothes during math class. "Kids need to be in places where they feel successful, where they have peers," Susan said. "Yes, they need role models, but they also need to be role models." Her parents found a summer camp for children with moderate to severe mental retardation, where Adam has gone every year since, and where his relative level of functioning is sufficient that he can help others. Susan had grown up in a largely non-observant Jewish household. She had an affection for Judaism as a culture, but limited knowledge of the Jewish faith. One day, Tegan said she wanted to learn more about Judaism. Susan went to the nearest temple to sign Tegan up for Sunday school and began to bring Tegan and Adam to services. "He loves routine," Susan said. "He loves schedules, ritual, the singing. Judaism really works for us because it has struggling and mystical stuff built right into it." Of the many nuggets of Jewish philosophy she quotes, she rests particularly on the Talmudic notion drawn from Exodus 37:9 that God exists in dialogue. "In the Torah, they describe building this huge tabernacle out in the wilderness," she said. "And on top of the vehicle that carries the tablets, they put two angels facing each other, because that is where God exists, between people. The day Adam was born, my life became purposeful, and it has kept purpose ever since. God exists between us. I knew that soon after he was born, but Judaism gave me a vocabulary for it." Adam managed to memorize enough Hebrew for a bar mitzvah. Shortly thereafter, Susan met William Walker Russell III, a WASP sound engineer with a recording studio in an old church, and when he saw her interacting with Adam, he fell in love with her. He remembered, "Susan said, 'I'm a mother of two children. One has Down syndrome and is going to be with me forever. It's never going to be just the two of us.'" Susan and Will married 6 months later. "Adam started wanting to dress like me early on, and it was incredibly complimentary to me and incredibly embarrassing to go out in public," Will said. "It's like, I'm wearing jeans, a brown leather belt, and a white Oxford button-down shirt from the Gap. He's wearing exactly the same thing. I figured I was in." Susan and Will's marriage coincided with the onset of adolescence for Adam. Adolescence is a challenge when it hits any boy of 14, but it's even harder for someone who is in many ways 4 and a half. "Will experienced the testosterone stage," Susan said. "Adam would all of a sudden decide to wreck the place. He would pull the fire alarms." Will said, "Adam was doing some testing of personal power. When a 4-year-old misbehaves, you pick the kid up and you take them to their room. Adam is not portable to Susan, so she developed a way of talking, showing unbelievable patience, and would spend whatever time it took negotiating. One time, he was kicking and spitting. I came behind him in a loving restraint, picked him up, and put him upstairs in his room. I remember the look on Adam's face. What just happened? That behavior stopped pretty quickly. Susan loves to dance, and she took up contact improvisation, which grows from the belief that dance is a way of communicating. A collective called Dance New England puts on a weekly session where people can dance barefoot and freestyle in an alcohol-free, welcoming environment. Susan had long realized that most of her communication with Adam was nonverbal, so this community had particular resonance for her. Other people with Down syndrome are very social, very outgoing, Susan said. He is not so much. A lot of the reason that I like the dance forms that I do is it gives you a way of interacting and connecting with people without having to talk. Every summer, the collective would rent a place in Maine on a clothing-optional lake for 2 solid weeks of dancing, with a strong emphasis on community building and volunteerism. Adam worked for 2 hours every day in the kitchen. Everybody wears purple, Susan said. It's a very nice affirming place for us. It's a time when everything Adam has learned during the year coalesces, and it prepares him for the next year. When Tegan was in 9th grade, she contracted mononucleosis and spent a long stretch at home, cared for by her mother. One day, out of the blue, she said to me, "You know that I'm always going to have a place for Adam, wherever I live," Susan recalled. When she said that, I started thinking about a team of support around Adam, that she is a willing part of that team. She came to that on her own. To Tegan, it had always been obvious. "In some ways, I was always the older sister," she said. "Sometimes I was annoyed about having to take care of him on a specific night, but I never wished for a life without him. His thanks is in the form of love, more than gratitude. I know he loves me, which is enough. I wouldn't trade it for the world." Will struggled at times with existing family dynamics. "The primary duo is always Susan and Adam," he said. "If Susan and I are talking and Adam interrupts, our conversation stops, and there have been times when I have resented that." The biggest tension when Will joined the house was sound. Adam's greatest pleasure in life is Broadway show tunes. "Shortly after I met Adam, he offered to sing for me. His sound is an enthusiastic monotone hum, like an amplified refrigerator. He usually sings along to his favorite recordings, to which he listens over and over at high volume." Will is a sound engineer whose life is in his ears. Adam eventually agreed not to sing in the car when Will was driving. Will figured out how to deal with sound in the house. "When I asked Tegan to describe life with Adam, she said, 'Slow.' Will concurred, 'It's about Adam time. Just like when you're hanging out with a 4-year-old, you give up your agenda. I've learned that no one says that nut has to be tightened in 30 seconds. If it's tightened in 5 minutes, it's all the same. Adam is my Zen master." Adam completed vocational school, then entered a work program, affixing labels and stamps and sealing envelopes. When that didn't work so well, he started volunteering in a soup kitchen, where he puts out the salt and pepper and rolls the silverware in napkins. "Being helpful is one of his values," Susan said. "In fact, one of the other Down's mothers said to me that she told her son that she would take him to something, but he had to be like Adam. Adam's always smiling, and he listens to his mother. and if you agree to be like Adam, I'll take you with me. So whenever he started being a little disruptive, she said, Are you being like Adam? It worked. Adam being a role model for a kid who is way smarter than him. Adam is not allowed any TV or videos on the Sabbath, so he listens to CDs of Broadway musicals on headphones. At dinner on Friday night, he blesses the bread. He does the ritual washing of hands as well. Then he takes a long mineral bath. He loves baths, but because he is prone to fungal conditions of the skin, he can't take them the rest of the week. Toileting is still an issue, so we have him on a schedule, Susan said. I would like to transition him to listening to his body more. He has accidents sometimes. We deal with his mental age. I was curious about what mental age actually meant. If you think about the level of supervision you might give a 6-year-old, or what a 6-year-old could do, that's about what Adam needs, Susan said. It might be more like 5, in some ways more like 4, because 6-year-olds can generally read more than he can, and make phone calls, and know what to do in emergencies. If the house were on fire, and he was watching TV, he wouldn't leave. Maybe when it got very, very hot. He knows about walking when the traffic light says walk, but he doesn't know to look around and see that a car might be turning. If we're leaving Adam in someone's care, I say, imagine someone who's been 5 years old for 10 years. He's Mr. Helpful around the house. He does all these things that a 5-year-old would never be 5 long enough to learn. Tegan added, if you gather a whole group of 6-year-olds together, they'll have a much wider range of ability than any single 6-year-old. So one might have grown up with professional parents in the city, so he knows about computers. Another grew up in the country and knows all kinds of wild plants and how to find their way around in the woods. If you keep somebody at a 6-year-old level for long enough, they'll expand laterally. That's what he's been doing. Susan has stopped trying to resolve the contradictions that her life with Adam tosses up. When he was born, my big thing was I wanted him to be able to communicate. Now I know that even people who don't talk can communicate. One birthday, Susan had bought Adam a black felt hat, like the ones worn in Fiddler on the Roof. She had bought him a Broadway compilation CD, and Adam's favorite song was One, from a chorus line. At the end of a day in Ithaca, Adam said he had something to show me, and I sat down in the living room. He made Susan find her own hat. He put on the CD, and the two of them did a little Michael Bennett pastiche of the dance from a chorus line, lifting the hats, twirling around, kicking at the right moments. Somehow, Adam had learned the moves, and with only minimal prompting from Susan, he did the whole thing, a little awkwardly but with charm. Looking at this private cabaret, I was struck by Susan's insistence on dance as a means of communication, and I thought that what the whole household had achieved was intimacy. Susan's genuine belief that happiness was a fluid concept seemed to fill the room with love. Some 3/4 of intellectually disabled people in the United States live with their parents. The natural desire of parents to nurture their children during their growing years should be especially encouraged for children whose progress is measured in centimeters, one study notes. Whenever families decide that they can no longer bear the burden of care, the transition to a residential placement should be facilitated. Empowerment of people with disabilities cannot ignore those who provide day-to-day care. The likelihood of placement of younger children with DS depends on the severity of their disability, the extent to which their behavior disrupts the household, and the capacity of the parent's relationship to withstand the stress of a disabled child. Siblings may need attention their parents cannot muster when someone needier occupies focus. Those same siblings may be deeply distressed by the placement of a brother or sister, feeling vulnerable to exile themselves. One study found that almost 75% of parents reported feelings of guilt after placement. Half said they felt guilt constantly or every day. Many feel that placement reflects their failure as parents. When the child who has been placed comes home to visit, families often feel glad and stressed. When the child goes back to his residence, they feel sad and relieved. They feel worse if their child is in a small facility, even though those are usually more humane. Small facilities resemble home, and the similarity forces parents continually to reassess their decision to send their child away. When care is provided by a small staff, some parents become competitive with them. Parents most often report that placement has made their functional lives easier, but not their emotional lives. Nonetheless, they seldom bring back children whom they have placed. The tendency is to stick with whatever decision you have made. Investigators note parents' positive feelings toward placement after they have placed their child. They likewise note the positive feelings of parents who have decided to keep their children at home. To some degree, people who will be happier with the placement are more likely to place their children, and people who will be happier with their kids at home tend to keep them at home. Ultimately, this is also a matter of resolving cognitive dissonance. People adjust their attitudes to fit their decisions so as to avoid internal discord. Placement is a process, not an overnight decision. Preliminary separations, through respite care and day or weekend programs, may allow parents to explore how placement will feel. They may, equally, allow parents to delay placement by alleviating some burden of care. In addition to their gradual psychological adjustment to placement, parents face pragmatic challenges in researching appropriate facilities and figuring out how to apply for the preferred ones. One person who has worked on this topic described how a mother told him, "I could never put my child in one of those places." 2 years later, she placed him in the exact setting that had so offended her. "Calling the regional center was the scariest phone call I ever made," one mother said. Many people with DS are placed between 18 and 21, at the age when typical children are moving out of their family houses. Some experts feel that creating a life course that mimics the stages for typical people is advantageous. The proportion of children and youth in institutions has gone down by about 3/4, but the total number of people in institutions has gone up because lifespans have lengthened. Though big state institutions still exist in 39 states, they have mostly given way to a vast array of smaller, more intimate, community-based care facilities. More than half of parents visit only one facility and place their children there, sometimes for geographic reasons, but often without regard to the range of quality of such facilities. In 2011, the New York Times reported hideous abuses at residential facilities throughout New York State. Employees who sexually abused, beat, or taunted residents were rarely fired, even after repeated offenses, the paper stated. State records show that of some 13,000 allegations of abuse in 2009 within state-operated and licensed homes, fewer than 5% were referred to law enforcement. One obstacle complicates any effort to take action against employees accused of abusing those in their care. The victims often cannot talk or have extreme cognitive impairment. Local law enforcement officials point to this to explain a lack of prosecution of cases. But another factor seems to be at work. In many cases, the developmentally disabled do not have families actively involved in their lives, and hence, no advocates. These abuses cast a long shadow over the experience of families who are grappling with placement decisions. Though spending on housing and treatment for people with intellectual disabilities in the United States averages $380.81 per person per day, The actual amount fluctuates widely from state to state, and even from county to county. Where families used to be counseled to separate themselves emotionally from the children they placed, many now remain deeply involved. Placement out of the home is not placement out of the family. Most visit monthly at least, and speak on the phone more frequently. Many parents want to be present to effect a progressive transition to avoid transfer trauma. The time to have a young adult go into a group home is when you're still around, Elaine Gregory advised. I hear horror stories of parents who have 40 and 50-year-olds at home. Then the parents die, and these 40-year-olds have to go into a new environment where they're asked to do things that they were never trained to do. Many retired parents who still care for their DS children describe them as a comfort in a world where many older people are isolated and purposeless. Nevertheless, most people with DS will ultimately need some kind of outside care unless their parents outlive them or siblings or friends take over. Few are able to live fully independently. About 3/4 of people with DS who are still at home when their parents die are moved to residential placement. Some people with DS thrive at home, and others thrive away from home, which reflects the personalities of the people with DS and the nature of their families. Living at home means a familiar environment, and ideally more love. Adults with DS who live with their parents may, however, suffer lack of contact with peers and considerable loneliness. As they grow older, such people have fewer things to do outside the house, and they tend not to learn skills for building friendships. One father, in rural Pennsylvania, a construction worker, talked about how happy his daughter had been through high school. She had been a cheerleader and a member of the homecoming court, surrounded by friends. Once she graduated, however, her classmates moved away to college or got on with their busy lives, and he ended up taking her with him on his truck every day. She worked at Walmart a few hours a week and had no social life at all. She lived for 2 ARC dances a year. In one recent study, only about 1/4 of adults with DS who lived at home could name a friend who was not part of their parents' social network. Alongside the memoirs written by parents are, increasingly, those written by people with Down syndrome, who constitute a vital self-advocacy movement. More than 800 self-advocacy groups now exist in the United States alone, and members address themselves to legislators, caseworkers, and parents. Many of them are organized under the banner of People First, an international self-advocacy organization that began in Sweden in 1968. In 1973, the first North American meeting took place in Vancouver, where mentally handicapped people gathered at a conference called May We Have a Choice. People First operates in 43 countries and has an estimated membership of some 17,000. Their website explains, "We believe that if we can learn to talk at our meetings and among ourselves, we can learn to talk to anyone about things that are important to us. We talk to our parents, our service providers, our caseworkers, to city councils and mayors. We talk to legislators and legislative committees, to governors, and even the president. Even though it may be hard to understand us sometimes, people listen to us because they know that we know what we are talking about." For people with intellectual disabilities to have organized on this scale, even with helpers, is astonishing, especially when one considers the prognosis for the condition even a few decades ago. Until the late 1960s, no one with DS had ever achieved prominence of any kind. But since that time, actors, activists, writers, and artists with the condition have emerged. The first major publication by someone with DS was The World of Nigel Hunt, The Diary of a Mongoloid Youth, published in the UK in 1967. Hunt was the son of a school headmaster who, with his wife, attempted to educate Nigel like any other child, and included him in the regular classes at his school. Nigel's book recounts his day-to-day life, with touching references to his mother's illness and death. Jason Kingsley and Mitchell Levitt's Count Us In is an often joyful and occasionally humorous account of their lives, including knowing descriptions of the particular challenges they've faced. In 2000, Wendy Smith, who has DS, addressed the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, reading aloud a letter she had sent to George W. Bush. She went on to serve on the President's Committee for People with Intellectual Disabilities within the Department of Health and Human Services. Many debated whether this represented exploitative manipulation by the Bush campaign, with one critic describing it as the most grotesque piece of political theater I've ever seen. The highest-profile person with Down syndrome for a long time was the actor Chris Burke, who starred in the TV program Life Goes On. But there have been many others, including Judith Scott, a fiber artist who died in 2005, and Luke Zimmerman, a young actor in the TV series The Secret Life of the American Teenager, who was also a football player at Beverly Hills High. In Germany, Rolf Bobby Brederlow, an actor, has a considerable following. Lauren Potter appears on the Fox hit Glee as a cheerleader with DS and has her own Facebook fan page. Arden Moulton described being with Chris Burke and having strangers ask for his autograph. "It was a mind-boggling experience," she said. "He was a star first, and a person with a disability second." The trickle-down effect is incontrovertible. A poised young woman said to me, by way of introduction, "I have Down syndrome, like Chris Burke." Research suggests that people with DS may have different learning mechanisms from typical children, and new studies are looking at whether the strengths of people with DS, who have, for example, unusually good short-term visual memory, can be harnessed to allow them to learn more, better, and faster. Because they hold visual information more readily than auditory information, teaching them to read as early as possible is especially important, and may play a larger role in their language development than it does for typical children. Many memoirists, including Michael Berube and Martha Beck, suggest that their children have forms of intelligence not to be found on IQ tests, islands of insight, ability, and even wisdom that come surprisingly readily to them. In his memoir about his son Ned, Greg Palmer says that Ned enjoys interacting with non-disabled people and engaging in conversation with them. The idea of isolating him among other mentally retarded people is anathema to his father. For many years, the Palmers avoided telling their son that he had DS, and when they finally broke the news, he said, "I find that a little hard to believe." His inability to grasp his limitations was one of the many indicators of his unpreparedness for life out in the world. Like many others with DS, he has a puzzling mix of strong abilities — he can play several musical instruments and writes good poetry — and sharp limitations. He is unable to take the bus across town without getting completely lost. Greg Palmer acknowledges that he has sometimes infantilized his son. He offers self-criticism on that front, and is similarly critical of a larger world that continues to infantilize Ned. He complains of a view of Ned as adorable and funny by people with whom he would like to engage at a more complex level. Ned is the author of this poem, which reflects his verbal sophistication, his naivete, and his longing. Girls. Girls are neat. Girls are sweet. They're the kind of people I love to meet. Teenage girls are what I love. They're like angels from above. I'm crazy for girls. I'm crazy for love. Girls are like the wings on a dove. When I grow up,